Live from New York, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to talk about how mindful eating helps you lose weight and keeps it off. Millions, tens of millions of Americans would benefit from this. And then from Osaka University in Japan, how a plant-based polyphenol is improving wound healing. That's good news because we get a lot of wounds. And also a top supplement for managing OCD. And many, many people have OCD. And, well, they're on steroids. They blow up like a balloon. Their immune system frequently collapses. So we'll talk about this and what you can do if you're having problems breathing and you don't know what else, because we want people to be benefited. Also, we're going to talk about today, strength training helps everyone over the age of 50 live a longer life. That's from Columbia University. Then I'm going to have a person who is going to share her own personal journey of healing. I had never met her. I met her last August at a health retreat, and then she just got in touch with me a week ago and said, here's my current status. I want you to hear from herself, that status report. Also, Hillary Clinton won New York State, and where I don't tell people how to vote, many times people vote for a candidate based upon their personality or something specific about them. But do they take the time to look at a person's background? I believe not. I believe if we look deeply into all the candidates' backgrounds, saw what they have done in their careers, what they really represent, that we would not want to vote for them. Today, Abby Martin, a journalist, is going to be here to give us an in-depth look at Hillary Clinton, the unknown, untold, unspoken, true history of her and her husband. That'll take about 27 minutes by itself. So we have a lot to share, and as always, we begin with that which can empower people, things that if we choose to, are based upon good quality science that can make a difference. First up is losing weight. The latest report shows that over two-thirds of all adult Americans are overweight, and a number of those are obese. It didn't used to be that way. In fact, I remember in high school, there were only two people that I can remember, two of the guys that I ran around with, who were overweight. Everyone else was healthy, athletic, lean. Not today. You won't find a lot of healthy kids in schools, but boy, when they get out of school, they really get unhealthy. So we have a dieting problem. And what we want to do is lose weight. Well, we go on all these stupid crash diets, of which there have been dozens. And temporarily, it might allow you to lose a little weight, but it comes back. A new way of helping you is called mindful eating. Now, mindfulness simply states that we're doing something by paying attention on purpose. We have an intent. Our intent is to be mindful of what we eat, how we eat, how many times we chew our food, and help with an environment that's not noisy and not distracting, where we can relax. Because always when you're eating and you're relaxed, you're having better digestion. In other words, being present in the moment. Mindfulness-based approaches have been used to help people with depression, anxiety, to help people who are going through rough times in their life. In fact, I have a friend who was going through a really rough time. They got a divorce. They were having problems at work because of several years of trauma and stress in their personal relationship. It was flowing over into their work, and they were being threatened to lose their job. And so I said, you got to just chill out for a while. and take a sabbatical. Take an unpaid sabbatical. And he said, and do what? What exactly am I supposed to do? And I said, go feed some koi, some fish. That's the dumbest thing I ever heard you say, Gary. Well, it may seem dumb in this moment because you're hyper-frenetic, you're very anxious, you've got more bills than you can pay, you're not in the relationship that you need to be in, and you're being judged at work, and you could lose that position, and then you would literally be homeless. So just take some time. And there was a place at a zoo, a children's park in there, where they had koi. And koi are carp, what we call Japanese carp. They're very colorful. But I have raised koi for decades. And you can get a koi to come up and eat out of your hand. You can actually pet the koi. The koi respond to human emotion. They have their own world. They have their own relationships. But they really like people. And he tried it. He thought it was stupid and new agey. But also in that same environment, there was a waterfall at the end of the koi pond. And it was a quiet place. And then each day he went for a little longer. And before long, he was spending a lot of time there. And then I said, go down, because he lives in California, I said, go down to the ocean. Be there in the morning at sunrise. Be there at evening at sunset. Be non-judgmental. And just allow yourself to be with the waves in the moment. And about 3 weeks later, I get a call. He says, man, he said, I don't know what happened. All I know is I see the world a little differently. And I realize it's okay just to leave the relationship, wish my partner well, because we had some good moments, and just go forward with my life. I'm back at work. I'm grounded. And everything's okay. And indeed it was. That's just one idea of what mindfulness can do. You let everything else go. You drop all the balls that you're juggling. Because what happens is, when we really get busy, and especially if we are a responsible person and others see it, and suddenly we're being responsible for other people, and some people have this habit of trying to save other people, which is a big mistake. Because you can't save people from themselves. They can cooperate in their own recovery, but you can't save people. Just ask anyone who's tried. All they do is waste their own life in the process. But with mindfulness, what you're doing is you're saying, which of these balls, these responsibilities am I juggling that I shouldn't any longer? And then you just let those go. And lo and behold, some people may not like the fact that they must be responsible for themselves. For example, I don't believe any teenager, no exception, should ever expect their mom to be their cook, their chauffeur, their banker, their housekeeper, their coach. No, they're old enough. Let them be responsible for cleaning up the house, doing the laundry, helping with food preparation, go to the farmer's market. There's so many things they can do to share the responsibilities, generally with an overworked mom. And today's breed of kids don't give a damn about their moms, with few exceptions. And as a result, they're just spoiled brats. And we all know that. And I'm not politically correct, so I'll say what the hell I think is right. And people can argue with the other. All know they're precious. They're little gods. They're little goddesses. They're princesses. You think so? Well, exactly how are you preparing them for the real world when they don't? They're going to get smacked down out there with the reality of a karmic life that they're not adjusted to because you have made them believe that they are more special than what they have earned the right to be. So, they want to be special? Let them show it by deed, by gesture, by action. In any case, think of the parents who are exhausted at the end of the day. There's just no energy for the things that used to give them pleasure, going to a concert, going for a walk, reading poetry, writing a book. Those things they might have done, did do, and now it's just sun up to the time they throw the wash into the dryer, put it on, and fall into bed. Why? Because other people are too selfish to appreciate the sacrifice people are making on their behalf. So I don't care what someone feels. I really don't give a damn about how you feel. And I think that's our biggest mistake and our absolutely spoiled, over-the-top, rotten attitude about don't deal with reality, but make me feel okay. I wasn't born to make you feel okay. No one was. You should make yourself feel okay by the actions and moral judgments. Do you treat people with respect and care about the others in your life, not just your own ego? Now, mindfulness allows you to realize who in your life has taken advantage of your over-responsible nature, where you can actually say, sorry, you gotta clean your own toilet bowl. I'm sorry if that upsets you, but you got to. Well, I've never cleaned it before. Well, it's time that you learn how to clean your own toilet bowl, isn't it? You don't do a damn other thing for anyone here. Do that. And I think that's a good place where a lot of young people should have their head each day in a toilet bowl and then get a little grip on life. Because, man, is this the worst generation in history? And it is. Mindfulness would bring us back to what is appropriate and inappropriate behavior and responses to these stresses. Mindfulness allows us not to eat the food because we're stressed, we're angst-ridden, we're angry, we're rageful, we don't know whether to express it externally or to destroy ourselves internally with it, but we got to do something with it. Mindfulness says, hold on a second. What's the likely outcome that if you eat that pizza because it's 11 o'clock at night, you're stressed out, you should be asleep, and now you're going to have all that gobbledygook in your body? Mindfulness says, why don't you take a moment, take a bath, take some magnesium to relax your muscles, put 3 drops of lavender into the bath water, and just soak and remember all the wonderful, remarkable moments in your life, something that you can appreciate. And tomorrow, get up as if you're starting over. Wipe the slate clean and say, here's what I'm willing to do for you. Here's what you got to do for yourself. If you choose not to, then that no longer exists for you. And then start your day over. And watch how everything changes, including your weight, your health, your vitality. If you think you're going to get healthy by keeping everything that is maladaptive and dysfunctional and just add in a new diet or pill, see if that works. It's never worked for anyone. It won't work. It can't. Change your perception, change your reality, change your behavior. That works. And how a plant-based polyphenol and accumulates them in damaged tissues is improving wound healing. And that's terrific. It's anticipated that results will be used in stem cell treatments for cutaneous disorders associated with various damaged lesions. Just think of all the people who have varicosities. Think of all the people who have different cuts and lesions that don't heal if they have diabetes. So this is good. So just write it down because you now can use this. I'll spell it again for you. It is a polyphenol, a plant-based polyphenol, all natural. All right? And it is CINNAMTANNIN. Also, for those who have any form of breathing disorder, look at Mullein, Mullein. Very important and can make an enormous difference. Also, you should look at those that build mitochondria, including PPQ, because you could be increasing new mitochondria in the lungs. And that would be terrific as well. Cayenne, as an extra hot nutrient, will vasodilate, getting more blood and hence oxygen into the lungs. Also, there are people in this society who have obsessive-compulsive disorder. So how do we help them? I was asked this question last night. First of all, there's not one known cause of obsessive-compulsive disorder, OCD. But some possibilities are abnormal activity of the brain. What I mean by that is neurotransmitter like serotonin and dopamine and dysregulation of glutamate. Now, glutamate is an excitatory neurotransmitter. It's also possible that just plain everyday stress can cause it. It's a way of escaping stress. Currently, there is no cure or treatment within Orthodox medicine for this condition. And a lot of the people get on antidepressant therapy. That doesn't work. Has terrible side effects. Let me tell you something that does work. So for all the psychologists, psychiatrists, nurses, behavioralists, here's something that could help with obsessive compulsive disorder. Inositol. Inositol is I-N-O-S-I-T-O-L. Now we find it naturally in green leafy vegetables, but I would suggest you take it as a supplement, about 500 to 1,000 milligrams, and it helps regulate the action of serotonin. And inositol has also been shown to improve in the severity and type of symptoms that those with obsessive-compulsive disorder suffer from, and also glycine. Gly, G-L-Y, cine, C-I-N-E. Glycine is an amino acid, and it plays a role in controlling the activity of neurotransmitters in the brain. It has also shown the ability to increase the activity of brain receptors that have anti-compulsive effect. And since it can serve to modulate the release of glutamate, glycine shows promise in helping to control symptoms. But also, I'm going to throw another two in there. Ashwagandha, A-S-H-W-A-G-A-N-D-H-A, ashwagandha. It controls the OCD behavior. It's an adaptogenic herb like ginseng is, and it can help manage both physical and mental stress. The higher the stress, the more it helps. And additionally, there is a natural antidepressant quality to ashwagandha. So that's very important. And I'll end with N-acetylcysteine, the letter N, acetyl, A-C-E-T-Y-L, cysteine, C-Y-S-T-E-I-N-E, or what is called NAC. It's an amino acid derivative. It's important for various aspects. It can boost the level of certain antioxidants like glutathione, which is great for detoxifying our liver. So anyone who has lead, mercury, cadmium poisoning, anyone who's had any kind of environmental poisoning from pesticides, you definitely want NAC in your body because you get more glutathione created for it. It also releases a more glutathione, but it also blocks glutamate release from brain cells, and therefore it allows you to be calmer. So just some things can help. And finally, strength training helps older adults live longer. This is from Columbia University. Older adults who meet twice weekly strength training guidelines had lower odds of dying, and that's a new research out there. So this was done at both Columbia University and Penn State College of Medicine, and it's the study is the first to demonstrate the association in a large nationally representative sample over a long period of time. And this was through the American College of Sports Medicine. So you want to live a longer life? Don't do strength training twice a week. Do it 5 days a week. You do it 5 days a week, it can help you live a longer life. That's the latest on health and healing. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Testimonial. Once in a while, we'll have someone call in the show who has been on a journey of healing, a journey of awareness, a journey of opening themselves up to even a greater potential than what they may have experienced prior to their crisis in their life. And there's a Zen saying, and it's a proverb, and it's very important. It is that each day, in the course of gaining knowledge, we should learn something new. ideally about ourselves. And a lot of people do that. In fact, my generation, baby boomers, really went for learning more. We became the most educated generation in American history. And then our children were expected to learn more. But there's where we stopped. We believed that knowledge in and of itself was the highest virtue of understanding of your place in the universe and how you could use that knowledge to gain. Unfortunately, what we did not choose to use knowledge for was to gain wisdom. Instead, we gained success. We gained material possessions. We gained status and a position of responsibility or respect within our given guilds, sororities, communities, our religions. And then we didn't learn the second part of that proverb was knowledge is surrendering something about yourself every day. That means that whatever doesn't work for you, the dark side of your nature, your limitations, your fears, your anxieties, your insecurities, there's a need to surrender that, to no longer have it be a force in the decisions you make, even at a subconscious level, what we call the epigenetic reflexive, meaning you do something, you say something, you feel something, and it's really not about what's happening in the moment. It's about what was put into your mind a long time ago, and it's been there. And how many times have we said something we later regretted? We did something we thought, wow, that was the wrong thing to do. But in the moment, we did it. We said it. We felt it. So from my interpretation of that Zen proverb, yes, learn every day about yourself. But learn in a way that knowledge never imbalances you. If knowledge only empowers you to succeed within the existing paradigm, then take a look around at the highly knowledgeable people from the Clintons and the Obamas, from Yale and Harvard and all the medical doctors, and then ask yourself, has their knowledge made it a better world? Has it empowered people? And the answer is no, because they stopped there. But wisdom is what we lack. We don't have leaders. Policymakers are opinion leaders. In fact, people in the media, with rare exception, like a Bill Moyers, we don't even have people who share wisdom with us. A Gandhi could never get elected. Martin Luther King would be killed again today. We don't want people to open that door that we're afraid to see on the other side. So when someone takes a journey, we're there or should be there to help facilitate the exchange of energy and ideas so that a person realizes there's a good outcome frequently to good ideas, but there's almost always a bad outcome with bad ideas. We have a woman on the phone now who wants to share about her journey. Her name is Kathy. I have not spoken with Kathy since I last saw her about 9 months ago, so we're interested in hearing what she's learned on her journey. Nice to have you with us today, Kathy.
Thank you, Gary. It's an honor to be here.
This is the first time we're speaking since I last saw you at the retreat, correct?
It is, yes.
Good. So first tell people about what brought you to a retreat, where you were in your life, and what you were struggling with.
Okay. In February of 2013, I discovered a lump in my breast. I was in denial that that could be anything because I live a pretty healthy life. I own a store that's called The Water Well, and I couldn't believe that this could happen to me. Although I was in a lot of stress, and I had a biopsy, and it turns out that I had breast cancer, HER positive, and it was in my lymph nodes. So I had the lumpectomy in October of 2013. During this time, I was seeing a naturopath. I was going through all natural, improved my diet. I was doing vitamin C drips. I was doing, I was trying to reduce my stress. And then the bump came back again in February of 2014. Meantime, so then that prompted me to go to Hippocrates, where I started to do a raw food diet. And throughout this whole time, I was encouraged to meditate and to trust myself, which is what I did. I had a lot of support, and but the bump had come back, and it continued to grow. And so then I saw you in Huntington, and you told me to see Luann, which is a nurse that guided me. And eventually she told me to come to see you in Texas, where I stayed for 3 weeks. Just prior to seeing you, I ended up having a mastectomy because despite the fact that I believed that I could cure myself and that we have the ability, I trust in God, with His stripes we are healed. Unfortunately, the bump was still growing. So Dr. Antonelli did laser surgery on me, and in 3 hours, I was finished with the laser surgery, and I was out on the beach. Then the following week, I came and I visited you, and you worked a lot with me doing some energy work, and I was continued my good diet, and I exercised, and I continued after I saw you to try and implement the things that you had taught me. And then I just had an MRI PET scan last week, and I am cancer-free. So that's pretty much what got me to call and talk to Luann and tell her to thank you for the help that you've given me.
What lessons have you learned in this process?
Well, I learned that you have to trust yourself and trust God and forgive others. I learned that there are others that are gifted, as I believe you are, to help with the energy work. I think that we can all help each other, I guess, with positive energy and diet, vitamin C, all helps. But if you believe in yourself and you're surrounded by good support, that you have to have that in order to get better.
But you also were encouraged, you were told by the oncologist you had to get chemotherapy or radiation or combination,
oh,
correct?
Yes, the whole time I was told that.
But you did not.
I did not get anything. I did, unfortunately, have a mastectomy, but I didn't get chemo or radiation, as I was encouraged to do pretty much from the beginning. So I felt like I was empowered and that I could take control of my health, and I did.
Now, when you were there, and this was just a coincidence, because when people come to retreat, they come for their own reasons. I encourage people to come to change their lives, to, in effect, start over and choose what is beneficial. As you hear me in my orientation, I say, you're going to hear a lot of discussion this week. You're going to be exposed to a lot of different things. Choose those that are reasonable to you and just let everything else go. And every day there'll be something new. But I had never had a retreat ever where so many terminally ill patients were, people who had gone through orthodoxy. In fact, there was one woman there whose oncologist came and didn't believe she would even make the flight. And yet she was a real trooper, and she did everything. And so a lot of you were in the same room each day doing the energy work and discussions. You saw some of the things that happened with people. Do you want to explain, without mentioning their names, some of the things that you witnessed and they shared with you?
Sure. I know that some people were there with lumps, you know, cancerous lumps, and that they had diminished while they were there. I happened to share the room with the woman that didn't think that she was going to make it, and then it was even thought, and I was warned when I was there, that she might pass away while we were there. And she was she left better than she came. She left better than she came, and she was excited for the treatment that she had. Another woman with MS, she couldn't lift her legs for 12 years. And she was married to a doctor. Unfortunately, her husband had passed away, and she came to the retreat. And when she first got there, we had to lift her legs. And by the time that she left, after 3 weeks, she was able to walk. And all you had to do is kind of hold her hand. and she could walk a nice distance. That was the most impressive for me, because you could actually see something. Other people were feeling better, but I know that she couldn't walk when she got there, and I know that she was walking when I left.
I remember on the last day, we had had Charles, one of the staff, and on one side and her cousin on the other, and they would have to lift her foot and put it down, lift the other foot and put it down. It took about 37 minutes to go from where she was staying over to the dining area. But on the final day, if you remember, I asked her to stand up unaided, which she did. And with a walker, she got out of her wheelchair, stood on the walker, and I said, "Now, take away the walker and walk towards me." And she did 8 feet. Do you remember that?
Yes, I sure do. I was there.
Everybody was taking pictures. What was interesting, mm-hmm. there were two Orthodox doctors who did not identify themselves at that when they came. But one came over and says, "I don't know what went on here. I don't know what this is about. But this is so alien to everything I've ever learned as a physician. We haven't seen anything like this." That's just some of the insights there. We'll post the full discussion with Kathy. Again, she is completely cancer-free, no chemotherapy, no radiation. And more importantly, she's empowered herself into her own journey of health and vitality. And we're happy for her. We had another person who has a similar story, and we'll hear from her on an upcoming program. But I want to save an adequate time for you to hear a real honest, uncensored report on the truth of Hillary Clinton's background. And to share this truth is a really outstanding journalist, Abby Martin.
As the circus of the 2016 presidential election grinds on, Hillary Clinton has posited herself as the candidate of the people. But not many candidates of the people have vacation homes in the Hamptons that cost $200,000 per month, or hang out with the world's billionaires. You know, it's hard to know who she really is. While once being a proponent of Donald Trump-type positions, like building a wall at the Mexican border, supporting torture, and opposing the same-sex marriage until 2013, today, Hillary Clinton presents herself as the anti-Trump, anti-Republican candidate. There's been a lot of outrage about the impression that the establishment has already anointed her as the Democratic nominee and has carved out her path to the presidency. But like in 2008, her guaranteed seat on the throne is being derailed by the unpredictable moods of the masses and millions of young progressive voters. She continues to play her shape-shifting game, morphing her positions to try to capture the support from her opponent. But the real Hillary is still inside. In fact, every layer of Hillary's career shows why. Far from being a candidate of the people, she's the top pick by corporations to do the real job of any U.S. president, be the CEO of the empire. And they're working hard to keep her on that path to the throne. Having been party insiders for decades, the Clintons have manipulated D.C. reporters, mastered the media spin, and have a well-oiled PR machine at their beck and call.
Hillary Clinton has done everything right. She has run a good campaign. She has outperformed in debates. She's raised money. She's got a great ground game.
As a Latina, I can tell you that Latinos all over the country are very excited about Hillary. Latina women are very excited about Hillary.
Knew from the beginning that when the conversation turned to foreign policy, that this was going to be when Hillary Clinton really shined. And I think that that whole exchange was probably one of her strongest moments of the night.
Undisclosed is that many of the people praising Hillary across the corporate media work at firms employed by Clinton's campaign and super PACs. It's not just paid pundits, but the reporters and owners themselves. From Chris Matthews to the head of the New York Times, a big gang of media personalities have financial and personal ties to the Clintons. But even with Citizens United and unfettered corporate funding, the establishment can't prevent an insurgent candidate like Bernie Sanders from winning with votes. Which is why back in 1984, the Democratic Party created a superdelegate process to further undermine democracy. Here's how it works. There's about 4,000 pledged delegates divided by primary and caucus results. But there's an additional 700 superdelegates that remain unpledged, meaning they can vote against the people's will to ensure nominees are handpicked party insiders. The single vote of a superdelegate is worth thousands of ours. Many of these people are current and former members of Congress. but dozens more are literally corporate lobbyists, working on behalf of every industry from healthcare to private prisons. Like superdelegate Tonio Burgos, Pfizer lobbyist and Clinton fundraiser. Or superdelegates Jill Alper, Minion Moore, and Maria Cardona at Dewey Square Group, a lobbying firm that works directly with the Clinton campaign and lobbied on behalf of healthcare corporations to craft Obamacare for their benefit. Then there's superdelegate Jeff Berman, top lobbyist at Bryan Cave, and former lobbyist for the Keystone XL Pipeline and Geo Group private prisons. Berman is even paid by the Clintons to round up other superdelegate votes. This unelected nobility comprises one-third of all delegates needed to secure the Democratic nomination. And the Clintons are surrounded by a flock of Democratic Party politicians who know the career benefits of hitching their wagon to the most powerful family in Washington. And with bills cajoling, Hillary had at least 500 superdelegate pledges under her belt months before the election had even begun. A 45-1 delegate lead over Sanders. This insane Democratic inversion plays out every time Sanders crushes a state, like in Wyoming, where he won by double digits but walked away with the same number of delegates. It's not just superdelegates investing in Hillary. Every arm of the corporatocracy has been hedging their bets on her for almost two decades. Alongside media conglomerates Cablevision and Time Warner, five of Hillary's top 10 political donors since 1999 have been some of the most powerful banks. Citigroup, Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan Chase, Morgan Stanley, and Lehman Brothers. But those numbers pale in comparison to how much Wall Street firms have graciously donated to Hillary's super PAC, to the tune of $15 million. Beyond banks, every industry has been buying into another Clinton presidency. Lobbying groups for private prison giants Geo Group and Corrections Corporation of America are bundling dollars to the Ready for Hillary PAC. Hillary's also been given more money from Big Pharma than any other candidate, and received over a third of total contributions given out by pharmaceutical giants. The defense industry thinks she's good for business, too. Defense contractor employees have given her more cash than any other candidate. Fossil fuel lobbyists are also working hard to elect Hillary. Her 2016 campaign received more than $4.5 million from lobbyists, bundlers, and donors connected to the world's biggest polluters. Their investment will pay off tenfold. Hillary has been at the forefront of promoting fracking, a dangerous and destructive method of natural gas extraction. And she's much more than just a supporter of fracking. She personally created a bureau at the State Department focused on spreading it around the world with one of her major sponsors, Chevron. The Clintons sell their friendship through other avenues, such as huge honorariums for speaking fees. Much like George W. Bush's motivational speaking tour, Bill and Hillary are quick to exploit themselves for corporate loot. But they don't come cheap. Averaging $211,000 a pop, Bill and Hillary made more than $153 million in paid speeches to elite think tanks in closed-door boardrooms since 2001. In 2013, the year after leaving the State Department, Hillary made $3 million giving just 12 speeches to Wall Street banks and financial institutions. This calculates to her earning $5,000 per minute. Seems like good, honest work to me. Demands to release the speech transcripts have been laughed off by Hillary. But we don't really need to see the transcripts because we already know what's in them. Her praising banks and committing to their prosperity. Although Hillary has recently tried to appear critical of Wall Street to pander to Sanders' immense support, her fat cat banker donors aren't worried in the slightest, saying her talking points about inequality are, quote, just politics. But how did Hillary Clinton become such a political force that the empire's biggest powerhouses and establishment elites flocked to her with money and support? Hillary was born in 1947 to a wealthy textile wholesaler who unsuccessfully ran for public office. She has two brothers, one a failed businessman, the other a failed politician. Both have their own history of public scandals. Hillary's first political work was campaigning for the Donald Trump of the 60s, far-right Republican Barry Goldwater. Hillary maintains that she was proud to be a Goldwater girl and writes off her support for the offensive character as just youthful ignorance. But the timing tells a different story. This was in 1964, when the Civil Rights Act was passed, after the Freedom Rides, after MLK's I Have a Dream speech at the historic March on Washington. Goldwater's campaign was an open reaction to that. Later, Hillary became president of the Young Republicans Club at her elite university. She says she later transformed, which is a common thing for Hillary, but her conservative past is more tied to her rise than she wants you to know. The Clintons' climb to prominence had everything to do with the political climate in the country. During the Civil Rights period, the Republican Party emerged as the new choice for racist whites. Reagan's sweeping victories in the South, ushering in 12 years of Republican administrations, put the Democratic Party in a panic. A younger movement within the party formed to win back the Southern vote, known as the New Democrats. And it did so through a conservative shift, canceling out hallmark Great Society economic policies and appealing to anti-black attitudes by distancing themselves from prominent black Democrats, targeting mythical welfare queens, and pushing so-called criminal reforms that targeted African Americans.
They're a new generation of Democrats, Bill Clinton and Al Gore, and they don't think the way the old Democratic Party did. They've called for an end to welfare as we know it, so welfare can be a second chance, not a way of life. They've sent a strong signal to criminals by supporting the death penalty.
Bill swept the Southern white vote on his Ending Welfare as We Know It and Tough on Crime coded racism.
We're making some progress. Much of it is related to the initiative called community policing, because we have finally gotten more police officers on the street. That was one of the goals that the president had when he pushed the crime bill that was passed in 1994. They are not just gangs of kids anymore. They are often the kinds of kids that are called super predators. No conscience, no empathy. We can talk about why they ended up that way, but first we have to bring them to heel.
Hillary Clinton tries to rationalize her support for these measures today as having unintended consequences, but they were precisely designed to target African Americans. At the helm of a right turn for the party, politicians flocked to the Clintons, which brought a new era of Democratic Party politics, adapting to the changing needs of empire. Neoliberalism was enacted through NAFTA, decimating American jobs and economies abroad. Massive deregulation of Wall Street and the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act set the stage for an economic crisis. Clinton's crime bill exploded our shameful era of mass incarceration. When the Clintons left the White House in 1999, their rise to political powerhouses was really just the beginning, despite Bill's numerous sexual harassment cases. With a plan to put Hillary in the Oval Office next, they moved to their new home state of New York, where Hillary became a senator the following year. While wealthy, the Clintons had nowhere near the money they have today. On their 1999 tax returns, they made less than $500,000. But by 2014, they were making more than 50 times that amount, reporting over $28 million in income. And that only scratches the surface of the cash supplies they've amassed. While Hillary went to work crafting a presidential resume in the Senate, Bill capitalized on his new super elite status as a former president. And the Clintons' way of cashing in on that access was by exploiting misery and disaster. In 2001, in response to a major earthquake in India, the Clintons joined the heads of Goldman Sachs and Citibank and embarked on a false philanthropy model that would define their Clinton Foundation. These development and relief charities act as an insertion needle for Western business. For example, some of the Clinton Foundation's so-called development projects in India, Africa, and Central America include forming for-profit farming corporations that exploit small farmers. The donations typically end up back in the pockets of donors, their companies getting the so-called development contracts to build up mobile networks and real estate. In the past 15 years, the Clinton Foundation has grown into a lucrative fraternity of the rich and powerful, which boasts of having projects in 180 different countries. Including its numerous spin-off affiliates, it reported total assets of over $351 million in 2013. The sources of cash for this political machine say everything about the true nature of this charity. As a nonprofit, the Clinton Foundation is not required to disclose donors or contributions. All of the funds disclosed on the website are in ranges and unspecified for what purpose. Other than a $25 million partnership with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the Clinton Foundation's large donor base is a motley crew of criminal corporations and police state monarchies. Giving a gracious $10 million is the brutal theocratic kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Matching the $10 million is the Viktor Pinchuk Foundation, Ukrainian billionaire oligarch who pledged tens of millions more to the Clinton Global Initiative to, quote, modernize Ukraine while Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State. Donating in the $1 to $5 million range are Gulf state monarchies Oman, the United Arab Emirates, Qatar and Kuwait, Saudi billionaire Nasir al-Rashid, ExxonMobil, Dow Chemical, Walmart, a company she has close ties to, having served on their board of directors from 1986 to 1992, Coca-Cola, Pfizer, Barclays Capital, Goldman Sachs, and Boeing, the number two defense contractor in the country. in the lower million-dollar range are such exemplary institutions as Monsanto, Chevron, General Electric, more banks, Bank of America, Citigroup, Morgan Stanley, UBS, Bank of California, and media giant Fox's News Corp. Then there's the Soros Foundation, an organization that claims to build, quote, tolerant democracies around the world, whatever that means. It's a win-win relationship, one that only continues to grow. The Clintons get massive financial support to run their machine, and their contributors get the perks of a loyal advocate in a position of power. As Hillary ascends off of this corporate sponsorship, the more favors she can grant, leading to more contributions, and so on. And while Hillary was in the Senate, these favors for her donors were numerous. Manufacturing giant known as Corning gave hundreds of thousands to the Clintons through their foundation and speaking fees. In return, Hillary introduced Senate legislation to allot hundreds of millions in federal aid to purchase Corning products. Notorious criminal enterprises Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae were also Clinton Foundation sponsors who won big by investing in Senator Clinton. She played a key role in blocking measures to regulate them, helping them reap super profits before facilitating the crash of the economy. The deal was good for business while Hillary was in the Senate, but the plan was always something bigger. After checking the box of having experience and having built a robust financial backing and political network, Hillary announced her bid for president in 2006, shortly after her Senate re-election. She was supposed to be the shoo-in. It was her time, as they said. But then everything blew up in her face. Mass opposition to the Iraq War marginalized her as a candidate. A little-known Barack Obama was flung to the front for his rhetoric against the war, while Hillary ardently defended her vote for the war throughout her entire campaign. Knocked off a presumed ride to the White House, she flailed trying to capture a changing Democratic Party base. Her campaign was criticized for its slew of dirty tricks, including an array of voter suppression tactics mainly aimed at the youth. Most pathetic was the release of a photo of Obama in a turban, pandering to Islamophobia and the strategy of thinly veiled racism the Clintons employed back in the 90s. Obama's campaign manager, David Plouffe, said the photo was the most shameful, offensive fear-mongering we've seen from either party in this election. But none of the schemes worked. And while today Hillary's media surrogates continue to call on close competitor Bernie Sanders to drop out, back in 2008, she held out to the very bitter end, refusing to give in when Obama was the clear winner. She only acquiesced and backed Obama after a closed-door negotiation, where she was promised a promotion and a path to succeed him. As Secretary of State, the rewards for her sponsors grew to a new level, and so too did donations to the Clintons. Her corruption is exemplified by the fact that 181 donors to the Clinton Foundation simultaneously lobbied the State Department while she was in charge. She used her position to divvy out repayment favors in a variety of ways. She funneled money from the State Department to Clinton friends and sponsors, like securing tens of millions in government grants for her dear friend and owner of for-profit education firm, Lorette Education, Inc. She also used her new title to help negotiate business deals between her donor friends and other heads of state. For example, she brought billionaire mining magnate Frank Giostra to meet the president of Colombia, scoring him access to pristine forests and coastline to be mined and drilled by his company. She did the same in Kazakhstan and beyond. Hillary convinced other countries to give up permits to be pillaged. In one incident, she convinced the Haitian government to issue a rare mining permit. The contract went out to a mining company that not only shells out millions to the Clinton Foundation, but her brother sits on its board of directors. She also flew around the world on the taxpayer's dime to act as a saleswoman for American corporations. For her sponsor Boeing, she made a personal pitch to the Russian government to purchase their jets. The result was a $3.7 billion contract for Boeing. The Clintons got a kickback of $900K as a giant thank you from the war profiteer. But none of these deals compare to her role as an international arms dealer. Her State Department approved a whopping $165 billion worth of commercial arms sales to 20 nations that are also Clinton Foundation sponsors, doubling U.S. arms sales to those countries under George W. Bush. These lucrative deals are undeniably rewards for paying off the Clintons. The amount of the reward directly corresponded to the amount of their donation. Her top donor, Saudi Arabia, scored the biggest, and so on down the line. Beyond the obvious step up from her corporate shilling as Senator and Secretary of State, wreaking economic and environmental havoc to line the pockets of Clinton coffers. A President Hillary puts us in great danger of catastrophic war. Another fact she's proven time and again over the entirety of her career. Clinton's war record is perhaps most exemplified by her endorsement from one of the world's most notorious war criminals, the butcher of Cambodia, Henry Kissinger. On the campaign trail, she bragged, "I was very flattered when Henry Kissinger said I ran the State Department better than anybody had run it in a long time. So I have an idea about what it's going to take to make our government work more efficiently." Yes, the relationship between Kissinger and Clinton is very close. Not only did she consult with him regularly as Secretary of State, her and Bill frequently vacationed with the Kissingers. Her other foreign policy advisors are quite similar, including PNAC founder neoconservative Robert Kagan, and even shares advisors with Republican war hawks like Ted Cruz. Her support for the criminal invasion of Iraq has come back to haunt her once again in this election, and now she's written it off as a mistake, and in one instance seemed to blame it on being bribed by George Bush with state funds for New York.
So I'm sitting there in the Oval Office, and Bush says to me, "What do you need?" I said, "I need $20 billion to rebuild, New York." He said, "You got it," and he was good to his word.
But she didn't just vote for the war. She was a key advocate of it, leading a right-wing minority among Democratic Party Congress members that favored the invasion over the old tactics of empire's domination. She called for, quote, unequivocal support for Bush's firm leadership and decisive action. She spread the lie that Iraq was in violation of UN resolutions, despite the actual weapons inspectors arguing the contrary, and continued to assert Iraq had WMDs despite it being, by that time, thoroughly debunked. As the U.S. and Iraqi body count grew and complete disaster ensued, Hillary still went around the country asserting that she had no regrets giving Bush total authority to invade and occupy Iraq. In 2007, she voted to give Bush the same authority again, with a blank check to attack Iran by trying to label their military a terrorist organization, a move rejected even by pro-war Democrats.
Today, Joe Lieberman, who authored the Iraq resolution, has authored another resolution, and it is essentially a fig leaf to let George Bush go to war with Iran. And I want to congratulate Biden for voting against it, Dodd for voting against it, and I'm ashamed of you, Hillary, for voting for it. You're not going to get another shot at this, because what's happened, if this war ensues, we invade, and they're looking for an excuse to do it. And Obama was not even there to vote.
Senator Clinton, I want to give you a chance to respond.
In 2008, Senator Clinton made the chilling and completely repulsive admission that if president, she would not rule out using nuclear weapons on Afghanistan and Pakistan. After her promotion to Secretary of State, she boldly planted a flag in the Obama administration to establish the Hillary Doctrine. According to The Nation, 24 current and former administration officials, foreign diplomats, friends, and outside analysts described Mrs. Clinton as almost always the advocate of the most aggressive actions considered by Mr. Obama's national security team. Of course, she joined Obama in creating and leading terrible affronts to human life and rights, like the murderous drone campaign in Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia. The program's mass civilian casualties, she says, she takes with a grain of salt. However, on other issues, she took the lead, showing how she would steer the empire's ship as she aimed for the presidency. In her book, she brags about her lead role back in the 2009 coup of the democratically elected leader in Honduras, further plunging the country into violence and instability. Also that year, when it was long clear that the Afghanistan war was an endless, unwinnable crisis, she lobbied to send far more troops in Obama's blood-soaked troop surge. When it was time to keep the promise of bringing those troops home, then Secretary of Defense Robert Gates says that Hillary argued forcefully against withdrawing the surge troops. She continues to advocate a never-ending U.S. occupation there. The same thing happened when it came to Iraq. Hillary led a minority that tried to convince Obama to leave thousands more American combat troops there, permanently. Today, she's to the right of Obama on Iraq yet again, advocating for even more U.S. troops and more combat. Then came what has been dubbed Hillary's War, a move Obama recently admitted was his biggest mistake. Oil-rich Libya is where Clinton sought to showcase her military doctrine. Masked in sinister right-to-protect jargon, Hillary is well known as the primary advocate for U.S.-led attack to overthrow the Libyan state, to feed on its resources, and hijack the Arab Spring.
As we came, we saw, he died.
lynched on television. His country tossed into an era of unimaginable pain. Right afterward, what everyone predicted happened. Strife from a shattered state, decimated infrastructure, and U.S. armed rebel fighters has turned...
And there you have some, but not all, of the comments on Hillary. On upcoming programs, we will have people who were present at the beginning of the Clinton political campaigns, when he was going for Attorney General of Arkansas, then Governor of Arkansas, and you will see an entire litany of crimes and why the media has chosen not to discuss it, not to consider it. And of course, what they're not going to discuss and consider, the American public is not aware of. And I believe that if you're going to vote for someone, which is your right, you should at least know everything about them that is relevant. So will we have another major war? Yes. Will we continue to have regime change and probably allow Israel to invade and destroy Iran? Yes, that is my opinion. Will we reposition NATO even more aggressively around Russia? Yes. And all of this to our undoing. Not everyone can understand all the different issues involving foreign policy, but here's a simple one. China and Russia are now partners, along with India and other countries, and Iran. To go after one is to go after all of them. Why are we trying to destabilize regimes? We can't even have a stable government in our own country. We have massive unemployment, 106 million Americans who could work or not. We have 18 million hungry children. We have over 150 million Americans currently living just above, at, or below the poverty level. We have more than 2,000 communities that are in great need of rejuvenation, with infrastructure crumbling, and we don't even have people capable of going 2 weeks without an income, or they virtually would be penniless. And yet we spend trillions of dollars on these foreign adventures, and she is the chief architect and sponsor of them. That's what you voted for, if you voted for her, even if you're not aware. I'm Gary Noll. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day.